Hello, and welcome to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple. Fred Burton is a New York Times bestselling author and a premier authority on protective intelligence and security. Writing alongside Samuel Katz, Beirut Rules debuted nearly 3 years ago. But you know what? It's still being talked about today. Other of his books include Ghost, Chasing Shadows, and Under Fire. We'll be talking about those and Beirut Rules in just a moment. I want to take a brief moment to say thank you for listening wherever you get your podcast, and I hope you'll subscribe to our YouTube channel. Now, how about you and I get in the Thriller Zone?
Thank you so much for having me on. That's very kind of you. I feel like I'm in rarefied air looking at some of your guests.
Rarefied air. Let me tell you something. You're among the rarefied air. How about that?
I don't know about that. I'm just grateful that you're interested in my books or Beirut Rules. So thank you so much, David.
Sure. Since this show has taken off, I've got such a stack of books to read, and I've always been a good reader, but I mean, like, it's gotten a little crazy.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and I get the publishers that mail me books, and I literally can't read all the books that I receive. And you know, you talk about just at times the nice people we have in this business. You know, Brad Thor and Jack Carr have gone out of their way to, you know, to have my book in their books. You know, the last to do that was Don Bentley with his new Tom Clancy book. And I had no idea he was going to put me in my book in his Clancy novel, which, you know, for somebody like me that grew up reading Tom Clancy, that's just such an honor.
Sure.
And he's just such a nice guy. I mean, this business, you know, for all the, you know, as well as I do, the business can be dreadful at times, but, you know, for the most part, I've met the nicest people in this business.
I would 100% agree. And I wanted to start out of the gate by saying thank you for your service, and what an honor to finally meet you.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you so much for having me on. You know, my work in the government was a long time ago, but it seems like yesterday. I think Bob Seger wrote a song about that.
Yeah, exactly. I have learned, it's funny, social media has a lot of blessings and curses to its nature, and I find that I spend entirely too much time Instagram stalking.
Who doesn't, David?
I know. And it's funny because just as I was setting up the board, my phone is pinging Fred Burton, official Fred Burton, liking a photograph. And I'm like, isn't it funny? Years ago, we couldn't have dreamt of this kind of access and proximity. And all of a sudden now, within just a click of a button, we're connected. And it's really awesome.
Well, it's amazing. Let me look at this. I could not have imagined as a kid growing up in the 60s and the 70s. And even when I started out as an agent, you know, when we had 3x5 index cards that I use to write myself notes, that was our Rolodex of names of suspected terrorists and stalkers and assassins. When I first started as an agent, David, we did not have a computer. And we basically worked off of old school accordion folders with cables and telegrams. And, you know, you would open one and it was like opening up, you know, Al Capone's vault. You never knew what was in there. Nothing was ever indexed properly. You would find case material from some other case. I mean, it was just one of just constant chaos. And, that was just the world we were in.
And I think about technology, Fred. I heard you on a podcast speaking to Piccolo, I believe, and he was talking about, you know, we've gone from big microphones and reel-to-reel tape recorders hanging on a wall to now microchips and microphones that can be embedded, you know, inside your ear. It's the technology that you've seen grow has got to be staggering.
Well, it's really amazing when you start thinking of just the evolution of technology in not only the everyday day-to-day use of people, but in the intelligence business and even in the book business. I mean, think about things we're doing today on social media with Twitter and Instagram and so forth. I mean, imagine how difficult it was when Clancy was first writing books or John le Carré. or Freddie Forsyth, and you know, you didn't have Amazon to order from or a publisher's website to order from, and people actually had to go out and visit a bookstore, and there was no such thing as a Kindle.
I know, that's crazy. And it hasn't been that long ago. That's the bizarre thing. And I heard this story recently about the span of technology and how fast it's happened just in the last 20, 40, 50 years, and what the next 50 will be, and the speed with which it will progress will be mind-boggling.
You know, I won't be around to see it probably, but when you start looking downstream as to where this will be 25 years from now. I mean, think about it right now. We have instantaneous communication. I mean, what's faster than a tweet or a message text?
Right.
And what's next? Is it trying to develop or being able to sort out these deep fakes or posited identification, such as how do I even know I'm actually talking to you?
Right.
Things like that. You know, what's on the horizon downstream to me is just fascinating to think about.
One of your fans said, and I love this because it's so true, no one makes well-researched nonfiction read like a thriller like Fred Burton. And I thought that is really superbly put. And so I want to start off the show with, how in the world do you do it? What's your secret?
Well, first, that's very kind of whoever posted that on my account. That's, you know, when you write books, you know this as well as I do, that getting those kinds of comments back really mean a lot. Not only has someone purchased your book, but they've actually read it and they appreciate the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into trying to get a book published, which we know collectively how difficult that is today. Well, for me, that's the part of the journey of putting a book together that I like the best. I'm in the process now of doing that for book number 5 for me. And I'm not smart enough to write thrillers like some I know on this call, but the nonfiction part, you know, for me, it's no different than a cold case. I approach it as a cold case investigation. For example, in Beirut Rules, and I'm very sad to say this, when I was an agent working the kidnapping and murder of Bill Buckley, I did not know a lot about the man. And a lot of it was because of the secrecy, and a lot of it was because of the lack of technology. We just did not have the tools to be able to Google Bill Buckley, station chief, sure, and to learn about that individual. So when I started putting the book together, one of the things I like to do with all of my nonfiction stories involving families, David, is I approach the families. And in this case, I approached Bill's elderly sister and Bill's very elderly significant other, Bev Surrett. And I said, hey, I worked Bill's case when I was a young agent, and I very much like to tell his story, but I want you to help me. Help me bring Bill to life. You knew him better than I ever would. And they were very reluctant and protective. And the other thing I did, David, was I approached the CIA right out of the gate. And I said, hey, I'm Fred Burton. I used to work on the hostage location task force. I'd like to tell Bill Buckley's story, and I want your help. And I actually went to Langley, and I met with the historian, and I met with one of their communications officers that worked for the director. And I said, you know me from my previous books, but I really would like to declassify what you can declassify from Bill's records. I need some pictures if possible. And if you can put me in touch with some of the people that Bill worked with at the time of his kidnapping. And, you know, it's amazing when you ask, you know, you do get help in this world. It's something I've tried to teach others, much like you and I. We help a lot of people in this business, and I got a lot of help from a lot of good people to help me put Bill's story together. So I greatly enjoy putting the pieces of the cold cases together.
It's awesome. I get the part about the, I certainly get New York Times bestselling author part, but as I was researching you, and I should know this, but I don't know it to the depth that I want to know it. And what exactly does an authority on protective intelligence security an executive production mean and do? It's a, it sounds like, well, it's a very handsome title, Fred, very handsome.
Well, thank you so much. I could maybe use you to help me with my marketing. In essence, back during the 80s, when I started looking and studying all the different kidnappings and attacks and bombings, I realized that how we were protecting people and buildings was simply not working. That, in essence, the bad guys were always one step ahead. So we started dissecting attacks from a lessons learned perspective as to how you could apply that in a practical setting. And in many ways, it's not rocket science. So, for example, protective intelligence is just collating all the threats and analysis involving a potential threat actor against an individual, such as when we were protecting Princess Diana, mm-hmm. who was a wonderful lady. We enjoyed her protecting her. Most people envision the protection team as, you know, the nice guys and gals with the Ray-Ban shades and the earpieces. And what dawned on me is that if we could put other surveillance outside of that protective umbrella, we could look for the threats before they got into the kill zone or the attack zone. So in essence, protective intelligence is analysis and investigations. Then the other aspect of that, David, is counter-surveillance, where you're actually on the perimeter looking for time and distance variables on individuals being stalked and followed and so forth. So we actually rolled that out first on the likes of the British royals, like Princess Diana and her children, Prince Charles, Yasser Arafat, others like them. And we're very successful with that model. So I get more credit than I deserve for that. But it's something that is very effective in the field of protection today. And most people never, ever see those counter-surveillance assets because they are fixated on that person.
Sure. And the element of surprise would be removed if you knew all the players surrounding the scene, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
If someone were to ask you, let's just say, for instance, they wanted to get into this field, how would you direct them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I get asked that a lot, not only via LinkedIn, but social media. And when I teach various topics like terrorism or protective intelligence, and, you know, there's really no set path to get in this business. Obviously, there are certain routes you can take, whether that be the State Department Diplomatic Security Service, which, quite frankly, I don't know how the heck I got in back in the day. Today, it's so selective and there's so many people applying for these jobs. The Secret Service, the CIA actually has a pretty robust protection team that helps cover the director of the Central Intelligence. Obviously, military experience helps to some degree. But what I see in the private sector today, which is really interesting, is there's a whole category of protective security agents and protective intelligence analysts that are homegrown, that are self-learned. They go to college. They might study criminal justice or homeland security or intelligence-related topics. And then they go to work for a Fortune 100 in their corporate security department, and that's how they go. And there's actually, I know a handful of individuals today that are getting their PhD in this topic, meaning global security or corporate security, which was unheard of, 30 years ago. So the industry is very much a hybrid today with a lot of formers and exes of this and that and all the alphabet soup agencies. And then we have 40 to 50% that are self-taught, self-learned, just working their way through the ranks.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that is if you want to be a cop, you got a pretty good idea how that works. You want to go into CIA, you got a pretty good idea how that works. FBI, similarly. But this seems like such a specialty. But I can see how if you had been in that, you were a police officer, so you would certainly know how that trail of events would happen. But I always find that interesting how people come about into those positions. And you've served on some of the most high-profile investigations, of course, one of the most famous, hunt and arrest of Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind behind the first World Trade Center bombing. And I want to know, if you can tell my listeners, what was it like to be in the world, in the circle of bin Laden's number one bomb maker? I mean, that would be such a heady experience, I have to imagine.
Well, I get more credit, much more credit than I deserve for that, David. That was a unbelievable team effort, and like in most cases in this business, in the 80s and in the 90s, you had to have a fair amount of luck. And one of the things that I was fortunate to be a part of was we had and hosted and created the Rewards for Justice program, which at the time was only a $2 million bounty, you know, for the likes of Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing, and others. It ended up being a $20 million program for bin Laden. It's extraordinarily successful. And I would encourage your listeners to check out their website, Rewards for Justice. And that program was in my office. It was part of our Protective Intelligence Counterterrorism Division, and we also had the Rewards for Justice program. So we got very creative and innovative. I didn't know you were going to ask me about this, or I could have pulled out one of my original matchbooks that we designed with posters on them. And, you know, the concept in general is just one that centers on the old Wild Wild West wanted posters, that if we paid people for information, they would come forth with information. And we were very successful with that. And in the capture of Ramzi Youssef, we got very lucky with a human asset, a human source who came forward and said, "I know where he's going to be." And, you know, of course, we didn't believe him, because we were getting sightings of Youssef all over the world. And a lot of them were just people after the reward that had no direct access. But lo and behold, this source did. And, you know, we worked the investigation in a period of, I think it was a little less than 72 hours from the time the human source surfaced to us getting Youssef in custody, was timing, like so many things in life, luck, being in the right place at the right time. We also had some logistical challenges in that this all took place in Pakistan. We also had to worry about getting a human source and family out of the country. So that logistically was highly complex. In those days, our relationship with Pakistan was somewhat strained or challenged, to put it diplomatically. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, a fair amount of good teamwork and luck to capture him.
You know, I hope this is the right phrase. I'm thinking of that first attack as a colossal breach of security. But do you think that moment created, for lack of a better term, a new chapter in our history as it pertains to being truly what I would call awake to the terror that lies on the borders of our country? And, or do you think it took something even more? Do you think it took the ratcheting up of 9/11 to happen to do so? Because it's certainly a demarcation of what was before and what is today.
Yeah, I think it was the latter, David. You know, even if you look at the first World Trade Center attack in 93, we actually had a preceding event, which was the political assassination of Rabbi Meir Kahane in New York City by El Said Nasser, an Egyptian, that was tied into the first World Trade Center bombing cell. And, you know, that was a tripwire that some of us in the weeds recognized. Whether or not we could get the National Security Council or the White House interested in any of these was always pushing a boulder up a hill. And it didn't matter if this was Republican or Democratic kind of presidents in office. We all, you know, just suffered from a lack of terrorism being a national priority. So we had the murder of Rabbi Meir Kahane. We had the first World Trade Center bombing. And that really didn't move the needle, quite frankly. It should have,
yeah,
but it didn't. You know, it took the strategic strike by Al-Qaeda on 9/11 to wake us up as a nation to the threat that existed. So, you know, I'd like to paint a different picture, but there isn't one in my mind.
It's hard to believe that it's been 20 years since 9/11. And I was watching a documentary just this past weekend, and the images threw me right back to that sparkly blue, fall day in September. And I was horrified all over again. And I thought, you know, everyone, such a cliche, but every American can recall that moment, 8:46 a.m. Eastern Time, September 11th. And as the memory haunts us today, I'm wondering the way we view security, since this is what we're talking about, is going to be forever changed. And, you know, very first thing that people think of, the longer TSA lines. But can you share with my audience what all of us can do to be more vigilant, and what we can do? I mean, there's the government and the police forces and such, but what can we do to keep that from happening again, and be prepared from that, when that were to happen again? Because something tells me you're going to say somewhere in this conversation we ain't seen nothing yet, or something to that effect.
Well, I think the burden of responsibility, and some may not like hearing this, is on you, meaning the person, the individual. Make sure that you have a personal plan, that you have a plan for yourself and for your family. You should have enough provisions in place and a go bag to be able to very quickly evacuate from whatever kind of natural disaster or act of terror that could occur. A lot of this in this business is about preparation and planning, and to at least think about what you would do in those kinds of circumstances. I'm shocked that, you know, here we are 20 years later, and, you know, we have horrific examples of everything from wildfires to hurricanes, and still you'll see a tremendous amount of people that are just not prepared, or they're driving around in their cars with, you know, an eighth of a tank of gas in their vehicle. So, you know, there's some just common sense kind of things that you can do. And, you know, having lived and worked in public safety for a good number of years, I'm smart enough to know that I'm not going to wait around for the government to try to come and help me, Fred Burton. I'm going to take matters into my own hands and recognize that the government is going to be overwhelmed with whatever event could be unfolding. And by the time they get to you, Joe Citizen, it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
So I think there's an attitude that, well, you know, the government will help me. Well, they can, and they will, and they do a damn good job of it at most of the time, unless there's an overwhelming event like you'll see unfold pretty much every day around America today, from just natural disasters.
It's funny, my wife and I have this running joke. She won't like me telling this, but she has a tendency to let the gas tank go a little bit lower than I do. I like to always keep it half or above. And so I made the comment, I'm like, you know, there's going to come a day when all of a sudden we won't have thought about it, and the tank will be low, and something will happen, and you'll have to get to the gas station. And my mind flashes back to the Northridge earthquake. This is a side note, but it has a similar feeling. And it was January, and the Northridge earthquake hit. And I only lived 2 miles from the epicenter, so I felt it pretty well. But within the next couple of hours, the volume of mayhem that occurred between people strapping on AK-47s to go to the 7-Eleven to get a pack of cigarettes, a gallon of milk, and some water was staggering. And I'll never forget that image. And I thought, it's just kind of the same thing over and over. When we are backed into a corner and a situation happens to that degree, to your point, yeah, Big Brother's going to help us out, but there's a whole lot more people every single day, and there's a very long line to get to you, and it would behoove you to be ahead of the game rather than behind by being prepared. This feels like a conversation for you, me, and Jack Carr.
Yeah, Jack would love this discussion. We have to drag in Brad Thor as well, and Don Bentley. We could have a round table about this. You know, between all of us, I'm sure there'd be some pretty decent ideas pop out of that. But something tells me that there's no better prepared author than Jack Carr at this moment in time, for some reason, just predicated upon looking at his website.
Yeah, between his artillery and his hunting acumen, et cetera. Yeah, he is. Nobody's going to surprise him, and no one will be better prepared than him.
I tell him this all the time. Every time I have him on my podcast or we chat, it always costs me money because he's always recommending something else that I certainly don't really need,
right,
but then I got to have. So I blame him for that.
Yeah, he's gotten very good at his job, that's for sure. I was reading an article on thehill.com, which I am now a subscriber of as of yesterday, and it was an article you wrote entitled "The Ripples of September 11th, Afghanistan, Counterterrorism, and Concerns for Corporate America," and it made me think, by the way, excellent article.
Thank you.
Made me think, do you feel that terrorism wasn't as big of a national priority back in the 80s and 90s, and why?
Well, it wasn't. Trust me, I've thought long and hard about this. I was talking to one of my former agent colleagues yesterday who called me out of the blue, just reminiscing about one of our cases that we had worked. It dawned on me again that it just wasn't a national priority. And I don't know the reason why. I think that if you look at this from a historical perspective, and I am a student of history, David, that it should have been, meaning why do we have to wait for 9/11 to see the damage that already occurred? I mean, exactly. My goodness, you go back to 1979. This is an interesting data point for your viewers. Everybody remembers the U.S. Embassy seizure in Tehran in 1979. And many attribute it to the collapse of the Carter administration as a result of that. Having said that, do you know on that exact same day in Kabul, Afghanistan, our United States ambassador, Adolf Dubs, was kidnapped and murdered? Very few people know that.
I didn't know that.
On the exact same day. So you can go back in time and look at the run-up, even preceding that. In 1976, we had the U.S. ambassador in Lebanon kidnapped and murdered. In 79, we had Tehran. We had our U.S. ambassador kidnapped and murdered in Kabul. We had the U.S. embassy facility seizure and fire like Benghazi in Islamabad in 79. And then you fast forward into 83, we have the first Beirut embassy bombing. Then we have the Marine bombing. We have the second embassy bombing in Beirut. Then we have the U.S. embassy bombing in Kuwait, and the list just goes on and on and on and on. So, you know, one of the takeaways I learned in this business, David, when I first became a counterterrorism agent was that you could kill Americans and you could kill a lot of them as long as you did it overseas and as long as you spaced it out. Because for the most part, there was very little impact. There wasn't Homeland Security. And it was very little impact on the day-to-day lives of most Americans.
Okay, hold that thought, and we'll be right back. From the New York Times bestselling co-authors of Under Fire comes the riveting story of the kidnapping and murder of CIA station chief William Buckley. Beirut Rules is the pulse-by-pulse account of Buckley's abduction, torture, and murder at the hands of Hezbollah terrorists. Drawing on never-before-seen government documents and interviews with Buckley's co-workers, friends, and family, Fred Burton and Samuel Katz reveal how the relentless search for Buckley ignited a war against terror that continues to shape the Middle East today. Pick up a copy of a nonfiction story that truly reads like a thriller. Fred Burton's Beirut Rules, available wherever books are sold.
You're listening to The Thriller Zone. And now back to the show.
Here's the question that always goes through my mind. How could it have taken 9/11 for us to finally go, oh, wow, okay, I guess we should wake up. And does that, you know, has our sense of alert just softened? Has it softened? Have we gotten lazy? Have we gotten overly self-confident, secure, and what makes us think that it wouldn't, that something of that level, if not twice as bad, is being planned right now?
Well, I think if you look at the history of just the element of surprise, going back to Pearl Harbor as an example, it almost takes that to move the needle for America, meaning we really have to get walloped hard in order to have these kinds of strategic shifts in our society. And let's face it, from a physical security perspective and from a threat perspective, most people don't think events can occur, nor do they plan for them. And quite frankly, it's so hard to shift bureaucracies in any kind of government organization. So if you look at the success that Al-Qaeda had against us going back to 93, a large measure of that was the entire intelligence community was geared towards the Cold War, towards the Soviet Union, towards communism, towards espionage. And we really were not very good at all in the counterterrorism arena. Even though we've been fighting insurgencies forever, we were simply not that good at it. So it takes these kinds of incidents in my assessment, in my lifetime. And even you can look at from a tactical perspective. I'll give you an example, David. I'm talking to a couple of the last men standing that were at Dealey Plaza when President Kennedy was assassinated. And talking to them, it's a vivid reminder of how unaware we were to that kind of threat. Now, you and I would think today, well, what do you mean there's no counter-sniper teams? What do you mean the President of the United States is riding around in an open-top limo?
Right.
Why isn't somebody looking for a sniper? It wasn't even in the mindset during that time period that something like that could occur. And so I think that's what happens to us as Americans. We need that shock and awe. We need that surprise in order to people to say, oh, heck, we better do something about that.
Yeah, it's a naivete, isn't it?
I think it's that compiled with a rigid bureaucracy that doesn't like to think outside the box, that it's easier to do nothing than to actually change. I mean, heck, I saw that when we designed the Protective Intelligence Program in the 80s at the State Department. Well, I can't tell you the number of people that looked at me and said, well, Fred, we've been protecting people this way for the last 30 years. And I would say, well, how well have we actually been doing that?
Right.
The point being is that there's always resistance to change. And there's always bad resistance to change in the security and the intelligence space. And it takes these kinds of moments for America to course correct. I mean, good, bad, or however you want to view TSA, let's face it, they've been effective at stopping bombings and hijackings inside the United States. Job well done.
Yes.
But it took 9/11 in order for that to happen.
And you may have already answered this in part, but I'm going to refer back to that article on The Hill. You made a phrase, you said a phrase, what do you mean by it's not the danger that we know that's the problem, it's the one we never expect? We're on the same line of thinking, aren't we?
Yes, we are. It's what's on the horizon that can surprise you, and have you thought about that? Meaning, we've all lived through and still are this horrific pandemic. And if you had wound back the clock before this occurred, and if you had walked into any boardroom, David, in America and said, you know, the world is going to shut down, there's going to be a global pandemic, people would look at you like you're crazy.
Yeah.
And so it takes these kinds of moments at time in history to have course corrections. And so today, and I see it through my discussions with corporate America, you actually do have companies thinking about these kinds of issues now, whether you want to call them the black swans, or you want to call the events that's over the horizon, what can happen to us next that we need to be thinking about so at least we can start planning for So we're not all running around like chickens with their heads cut off when it happens.
Back to your point about keeping your car and your home and your person prepared, the go kit, the plenty of water, the batteries, the artillery, the food and so forth. You said black swans. I'm not familiar with that phrase.
That's the phrase that, in essence, where something comes out that surprises you, such as everybody's used to white swans. And so when you see a black swan, it's like, oh my goodness, where did that come from? So a black swan event is that kind of game changer that nobody's expected, but it just exists out there and rears its ugly head and causes usually a catastrophic event. And you'll hear that term also being used on 9/11 for what brought down the Twin Towers, which actually even surprised bin Laden. But, you know, an event that causes so much chaos that you're least expecting it. It's a low probability, but high impact kind of event. And those are the kinds of things we're dealing with right now with the pandemic. You know, this is something that forever in national intelligence estimates, people discussed that pandemics are something we need to be worried about. You've actually touched on something that I've given a great deal of thought about. Quite frankly, some of these issues are so complex and so huge for a range of different variables that it's almost impossible to get in front of at times. And I think terrorism was one of them in retrospect, meaning if you looked at all the domestic acts of terrorism we had in the 60s and the 70s, and then you look into the international acts of terrorism in the 80s and the 90s, you would think that we would have been better prepared predicated on what's happened to us before.
Right.
But we weren't. And I did a keynote for the State Department about a year ago, looking at the evolution of this. And it's not as though these haven't happened before. And it's like we never learn from things that have happened in the past. And it takes these kinds of catastrophic events, whether it be a JFK in Dallas or an RFK in Los Angeles, the assassination of Robert Kennedy by Sirhan, to cause the Secret Service and the Congress to protect those running for public office. So you do need these events at times, I think, to force change that's usually mandated by Congress.
There's something I want to jump back to because you caught my attention on something I'd never thought about before. You made a comment about it even surprised bin Laden. What did you mean by that, the tower destruction itself?
Yeah, I don't think he ever expected that operation to be as successful as it was, predicated upon some of the evidence that was recovered when he was hunted down and killed by SEAL Team 6, in that if you looked at some of the messages and some of the writings, that I don't think they ever thought that they could collapse the actual towers when they hit it. Now, I know from the work we did in the 93 bombing that, you know, quite frankly, if you look at some of the explosive modeling that we had looked at the time period, that tactically, if that device had been placed street side at a busy Manhattan lunchtime, you probably would have killed a heck of a lot of more people and had more casualties than by burying that van in the basement of the Trade Towers. And so thank goodness that was not placed street side, similar to what we saw at Oklahoma City. So, you know, sometimes you have to be grateful that the terrorists do make tactical mistakes. But, you know, so there's a lot of lessons to be learned by studying these previous events in order to try to defend them better going forward.
I'm surely going to rattle a cage in some form or fashion with this next comment. But when I was reconsidering recently what happened on the steps of the Capitol on January 6th, I can't help but wonder, couldn't help but wonder then, can't help but wonder then, did some of those threats come from outside powers or right in our own backyards? Because it was another, I felt like, turning point in the collective consciousness of America that would force us to rethink that situation. No one ever would have thought, oh, a bunch of clowns are going to break into the Capitol and have their way with the building. And I just thought, you know, did those threats, was it solely outside or inside? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've been interviewed a lot on this, and I've written about this, David. And in essence, when you start thinking of protective intelligence failures, that is one, meaning you had all the signals resonating loudly that there were going to be problems. So why wasn't the U.S. Capitol Police better prepared? Now, I know the U.S. Capitol Police. We used to work with them. We used to do a lot of joint protective operations with them. They're a darn good outfit. They are one of the best trained, huge staff. They actually have a protective intelligence division. So why were they so surprised? And I think in many ways, what happens with the element of surprise, like we had just chatted about, mm-hmm. it's much like what happened to our five young agents in Benghazi when they were overwhelmed, meaning at times it's like the frog in the boiling pot.
Yeah.
It's like, when isn't Al-Qaeda planning to kill you? When isn't Washington having a demonstration? When isn't there another threat on the horizon? And if you look at Washington, D.C. in general, there are demonstrations every day somewhere. And some of them are quite large. I've monitored and been in a lot of them and watched them. And so there were some tactical failures leading up to that. That is almost, I think, part of the problem, meaning that look at the organization. It's very political. I've had several people tell me this, that they just don't have one boss there. They've got all the different members of Congress that think they're experts in security, and this is a public building, and everybody's got their opinion as to how that should be protected. So there's so many cooks in the U.S. Capitol kitchen that it's almost impossible to do your job. And that's part of the problem in any kind of inside the beltway issue. But on a practical level, there is no excuse for what happened, because not only do you have a great department in the U.S. Capitol Police, but you have the U.S. Park Police, which is one of the best crowd control organizations I've ever worked with there. You have the D.C. Police, the Metropolitan Police Department. You have hordes of federal agents from the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force that are there. So why does this happen? And again, there's so many cooks in that kitchen that it's impossible to get the decisions made at times.
Yeah. And I don't want to spend too much time on that, but I knew you'd have some very specific thoughts. And you got three layers that you're talking about, three prominent layers. But let's get to the book, because I realize that I'm going to turn around. You and I could talk forever, and before I turn around, we're going to have run out of time. So four books, and I can't wait to hear what's number five. So we got Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. We got number two, Chasing Shadows, which a lot of people just rave about, a special agent's lifelong hunt to bring a Cold War assassin to justice. Number three, Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack of Benghazi. And the one we're talking about today, Beirut Rules, The Murder of a CIA Station Agent and Hezbollah's War Against America. And I realize that I am saying Hezbollah the way I've heard the press say it. You say it differently. And every time I heard you say it differently in a podcast recently, I'm like, okay, I need to change the way I say it.
Well, when you start looking at an organization like Hezbollah, it is one that, again, the element of surprise was one that we always struggled with. We knew that we had this organization in the 80s called the Islamic Jihad Organization. We suspected that they were linked to Hezbollah. We kind of thought that the Iranians may have had a role with this, but we lacked a high degree of very specific evidence. And we would sit around and argue about this all the time, you know, the degree of Iranian control. And it's one of those things that it should not have surprised us like it did. But, you know, the element of surprise when you look at Bill Buckley, who's the centerpiece of the story, I mean, he was 13 when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And his sister told me, you know, the family would sit around the radio listening to this. And that was one of those pivotal moments in America. And so when the U.S. Embassy is bombed in 1983 at a very fortuitous time by Hezbollah, Bill volunteers to go. Wow. And he had been at the agency for almost 20 years at that point. He was 55 years old. He was a war hero. He had been decorated first as an 18-year-old young man in Korea, a Silver Star recipient for rushing a machine gun nest. And then in Vietnam, he was a recipient of a second Silver Star for gallantry under fire. So this was the type of man that he was, that was always running towards danger. And there was something about him that was just different, David. And that's why I wanted to tell Bill's story.
There you go. That's what I wanted to know, because I was only vaguely familiar with this name. And once I started reading the book and getting to know you better and your purpose of this book, I thought, this is a true blue American hero, to the likes of which I haven't seen in a very long time. And I just wonder, you know, first, you've now told me why you wanted to write the book. What were your personal insights and your feelings as you got to know Mr. Buckley? I mean,
well, it was very emotional when you started talking to friends and family. I mean, this was one of these silent warriors that literally, you know, joined the military as soon as he graduated from high school and volunteered to go to Korea, where he served with the 1st Cav, and then comes back, takes advantage of the GI Bill and gets his college degree and learns a couple languages. And then as soon as he could, he volunteers to go back into the military, where he becomes one of Kennedy's first Green Berets, and he's shipped off to Vietnam. And, you know, part of the book that I enjoyed putting together was the family gave me or entrusted me with the old-fashioned selfies. They were black and white pictures of Bill from Vietnam with on the back his handwritten notes, you know, such as "Hot as hell here, honey. I'm just trying to survive." Wow. And it really painted a picture of a guy who always wanted to be a soldier and always wanted to serve his country. And he was quite good at it. He was a paramilitary officer inside the CIA. You know, and those are they are at the tip of the spear. You know, these are the teams that are in the Benghazis of the world and in the Kabuls of the world before we vacated. And Bill was always going around the world to these hotspots. So when the embassy bombing happened in 83, and literally the eyes and ears of U.S. intelligence is wiped out in Beirut, Bill raises his hand and says, "I'll go." And, you know, these kinds of people, don't get me wrong, we have dedicated men and women that are volunteering to serve our great nation every day around the world. And Bill was one of them. And because of his efforts, he got U.S. intelligence back up and running when we needed it badly, because we were getting our rear ends kicked by this group in targeting Americans and planning hijackings and additional kidnappings and so forth.
Now, you said, I think in this book, you took Bill Buckley's abduction in Beirut to make CIA protect other station chiefs so that it doesn't happen again. Do you feel that Washington has become more or will become more proactive than reactive in the future? And I think this may be one of your pulpit points, isn't it?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, tragedy forces change. Even if you can go back to my book, Chasing Shadows, you had an Israeli intelligence officer assassinated in 1973 in Bethesda, Maryland. And it took that assassination for the Israeli intelligence service to start protecting Israeli diplomats around the world. And so you fast forward to 1984, when Bill was kidnapped. As a result of his kidnapping, the CIA changed and they started doing a better job of protecting their people and their chiefs of station, their lead officers in any country. And you know, you could sit there until you're blue in the face and say, well, shouldn't they have been thinking about this ahead of time? Well, you know, hindsight is 2020. Buckley decides to go into Beirut to stand up our intelligence eyes and ears in a time period when he needed to be flexible, needed to work the streets, needed to work his sources, needed to meet with the Lebanese intelligence service and the French and the Brits. And this was a guy that, you know, again, had spent 20 years fighting enemies all around the globe. And this was just another enemy. And unfortunately, this enemy caught up with Bill. And, you know, it was a horrible way for him to go.
And such a shame that a guy so brave that risked his life so many times and continued, as you said, going to face into the fire would be taken that way.
Yeah, it was his worst fear, too. His friends and family, Bill had had a friend kidnapped and held at the in Vietnam when he was there. And Bill was always worried that he could be kidnapped. You know, when he would confide with his friends, he would say, you know, that's my worst fear. And for that to materialize like that, and, you know, that's something I never knew when I was looking for him either. And, you know, when you do one of these stories, David, and you know, guilt's a powerful driver as well. You know, I really wanted to do more. We all tried to do more to find Bill when he was in captivity, but we simply lacked the intelligence assets on the ground. We literally had no human intelligence to help us. We were getting very little information from our friends, and heck, they were battling their own series of hostages. You know, the Brits had hostages, the French, the Germans, the South Koreans, the Russians, and everybody was out looking for their hostages, but nobody had any information. And you know, Bill was held literally behind enemy lines in a Hezbollah stronghold. And whether we could have rescued him or not, if we could find him, is a different story. But I want to believe that we would have tried if we could have put eyes on a building that he might have been in.
Yeah. We're getting close to the time to wrap, and I want to be super respectful of your time. There's a couple of quick little points I want to make, and one of them is I want to go back to something because, again, watching this these documentaries about 9/11 and seeing the planes hit, it was such a visceral moment of seeing a plane hit the building. You're like, okay, I'm not actually seeing that. And I think I was watching your appearance on Glenn Beck's show, which was fascinating. It was like an hour and a half. I was riveted to it. And you were talking about today's terrorists, and I heard you say how terrorists are laser focused. This is the phrase you said, laser focused on aviation when it comes to harming us. As you refer to it as, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the perfect terrorist vehicle. Can you tell me more about that? It just really caught my attention.
Yeah. Well, thank you for watching that interview. Glenn has been very, very gracious to me and for my books over the years. And it was an honor to be on his podcast. If you look historically, you know, modern day terror really has used certain vehicles or implements to really shock and awe all of us. And one has been the vehicle-borne improvised explosive device, your traditional truck or car bomb. And the other has been the use of aviation. And that goes back to groups such as the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, General Command, and Black September. And then Hezbollah followed up with the hijackings of, for example, TWA 847. So if you look at the evolution of these groups, they really stand on the shoulders of other giants that have been successful in the terror space. So it did not surprise me in the least that Al-Qaeda took advantage of aviation, because it's your perfect terrorist vehicle. You've got captured people from all around the world. You've got families, you've got women and children. It like defines terror. It's almost like those Munich moments where you've got a flying missile that you can guide it wherever you want it to be.
Right.
And it presents such unique challenges for the counterterrorism effort, meaning what do you do Does the U.S. military shoot that plane out of the sky that's headed towards New York City? I mean, it paints such a horrible set of choices for you. And then from a counterterrorism resolution standpoint, and I've worked a lot of hijackings and I've debriefed a lot of hostages being held on a aircraft. It's just sheer fright. And you don't know if it's going to get blown up, crashed, or if the rescue team is going to come in and start killing everybody by mistake. So that's what I meant by that when I was on the Glenn Beck show.
Okay. Okay. And back to the element of terrorism and the massive disdain, hatred that many have for Americans. Do you think that in our lifetime, Fred, and those of our children and even grandchildren, that this is going to continue to remain the same situation?
Yes, I do. I would like to think that it would dissipate in some capacity, but if you look at this as a student of history, you can see that this has been around for a long time. And I don't think in any capacity will this diminish over the next foreseeable future. And certainly not in my lifetime or in my children's lifetime, I'm sad to say.
You know, it's interesting. You know, you hear something and you hear it a certain way. And it isn't until you hear it put a different way that the image shifts in your mind. This is what I mean. I read the title Beirut Rules, and I heard it as a verb, Beirut Rules. And then I heard you make a comment, or I read a comment, and you were talking about, no, Beirut Rules as in a noun. And so it seems as though in the past there have been a form of, I think I'm borrowing this true, an unspoken agreement, what my dad used to call a gentleman's agreement, where you would play by certain rules and you'd go, okay, well, you know, we're going to come after you, but you know, we're going to do it this way. We'll have this gap in the time that allow you to kind of gather your forces, but there's this gentlemanly rules. But now I get a sense that you're saying, with both in part in the book and in general, that there's this sense of all bets are off.
Without a doubt. You know, the Cold War changed that.
And by the way, was that all over the place and completely incoherent, or did you?
No, I know exactly what you mean. Okay. We used to live in the espionage Cold War days on what was called Moscow rules, where our diplomats, our intelligence officers didn't attack each other. And Beirut rules changes that. And it's okay then to kill. It's okay to pick up the eyes and ears of a U.S. intelligence anywhere in the world and hold them hostage and let them die in a miserable kind of situation. And that's the asymmetric war that we're engaged with today. And thank goodness we have a tremendous number of brave men and women around the world that is trying to get in front of these threats, but it's not an easy task.
And I don't know if this is a tangent, but somewhere along the lines, as I was reading headlines, I was thinking of when I was thinking of the phrase in Beirut rules and all bets are off, and my mind went down, and I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, but I want to touch on the murder of Khashoggi, because in all of your work as an agent and so many levels throughout your career, have you ever seen anything, and I think the phrase I want to use is diabolical or flat out dismissive, but have you ever seen such a lack of humanity in his, you know, a quote unquote disappearance?
Well, that certainly was a horrific act of terror, but as shocking as the murder of Daniel Pearl, and the list just goes on and on and on. I mean, look, David, you can look at all these events, you know, whether it be the Munich massacre when the 11 Israeli athletes were lined up and gunned down by the Black September organization. And you can think about the gun put to the back of the head of U.S. Navy diver Robert Stedham during the hijacking of TWA Flight 847, and he was shot and killed and his body dumped on the tarmac. And the murder of Leon Klinghoffer on the Achille Lauro hijacking by the PLF. So the list just goes on and on and on. So brutality is, you know, par for the course in the terrorism arena, I'm sad to say. And that's just part of their theater when it comes to what they're trying to project around the world and amplified significantly on social media, which we discussed when we first started. You know, there's no shortage of that on any given day.
And maybe you just answered my question there, but, and I'm going to steal this from Glenn Beck again from that same conversations, but I think he was close to the end of the conversation and it was so perfectly timed too. And I'm like, what keeps Fred Burton up late at night?
Well, I think today, certainly when you look at the raging pandemic that has caused so much chaos on the world, and then you look at the events of January the 6th at the U.S. Capitol, and you think about our nation and our society that is so fractured and in many ways polarized, that those are the kinds of things that worry me strategically as I look over the horizon. And for example, when I was at FBI headquarters the day that Timothy McVeigh set off the car bomb in Oklahoma City, and John O'Neill was there, God rest his soul. He perished in the Trade Towers collapse on 9/11. And we looked at that carnage and we said, this has got to be Middle Eastern terror. And it has to be Hezbollah. You look at the scope and the size of that blast and the damage that was done, and you put up the picture of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, and you put up the picture of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. And what worries me, David, as you look at our fractured nation, is that, you know, will we see the rise of another Timothy McVeigh in some capacity? And, you know, you get back to the ones we know about, don't really worry me. It's the ones that we don't know about that tend to come back and haunt us. And that's what keeps me up at night.
Gotcha. I'm going to sound like I'm being overly playful, but back to our opening conversation about Instagram, I want to bring in images of Sasha. Happy thoughts.
Yeah, she's a good girl. Yeah. We recently adopted a new lab from the Hearts of Texas Lab Rescue, which is a wonderful organization. We've adopted two previous labs there, and I always try to figure out a way to work my labs into whatever story I'm working on. So those that are attentive to details with my books will be able to pull out a few names, and stay tuned for Sasha's.
Well, okay, so we've been talking about Beirut rules, the murder of a CIA station agent, and Hezbollah's war against America. Now, what is book five? Are you talking about it yet? Can you give us an inside scoop? Do you have a title? How far away is it? Are you from that book?
Well, I can't talk about it yet, okay. But I will say this, that I'm going to be shining what I think is a spotlight onto a certain story that needs to be told, because I'm a firm believer of that similar to the vein of Chasing Shadows and Beirut Rules, where bringing some cases to light that are long forgotten and people should have more visibility into them, good, bad, and indifferent as a nation.
Next year, I'm guessing?
Well, inshallah, I would like to hope that we would see it published by 2023, maybe.
Okay.
Awesome. Nonfiction takes a while, and I've got to run it through the publication review board at the CIA, which, you know, they do good work. They've got a tough job, and they're always criticized, but I'm sympathetic to their plight because there's so many people writing books today. It's, as you know, it's a challenge.
It can be a little daunting. I think of this very often, but I cling to the fact, yes, even amongst all the vast people crafting all sorts of stories, if you have a particular story with a particular voice and a particular message, it will find its audience. I believe, if I didn't believe that, I just wouldn't do it.
Oh, I agree with you. And like my previous books, whether it be Chasing Shadows or Under Fire or Beirut Rules, I really have been surprised at some of the things I've uncovered with this new story. So we'll see. Will, you know, people find it of interest? I think so. But as you and I both know, it's a tough business.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even get to this, but I do want to give you a quick plug that, folks, you got to catch Fred's podcast, the ONTIC Protective Intelligence Podcast. Give us a 1-minute blurb on what your podcast is about.
Oh, why, thank you, David. You're very kind to mention that. I try to look at unique topics in the field of protection or security or safety. And of course, we've had Brad Thor on and Jack Carr. And then we also have had some very interesting people on, to include one of the individuals that really helped design the polygraph program for U.S. intelligence. So we've had everything on from technical surveillance. I've got a new one that dropped today with the director of the ADL's Office of Extremism, talking about some of the trends he's seeing with hate around America today. So I'm always looking for interesting people to have. And so have a listen and let me know what you think.
Awesome. Well, folks, you can learn more about Fred at officialfredburton.com. And of course, follow Fred on all his social channels. Meet dog, beautiful, beautiful pup, Sasha. I did do this, Fred, as I was waiting for you to come on. I thought he's going to appreciate this. So here's, folks listening won't be able to appreciate it, but there's my Dexter.
Oh, wow. Dexter looks like a good boy there. Hopefully you put that on Instagram.
I will do that today just for you. Yeah, he almost got a little piece of a UPS delivery guy yesterday. Yeah, I had to take him out to the dog shed and say, we can't do that.
Yeah, he looks like a good boy. So yeah. Thank you for sharing that. We need to see him on Instagram.
He will be there. And Fred, thank you so much, not only for your service, your kindness, but your time and fighting the good fight and providing great stories and facts for everyone to read. It's just really been a delightful time to spend with you.
Well, you're very kind, David. I thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks to Fred Burton for his talents, time, and service to his country. Now, let's look ahead to next Friday's The Thriller Zone, when I'll welcome Suzanne Chazen. Suzanne's the award-winning author of The Fragile Edge, a story that Lee Child calls first rate. Suzanne's fiery protagonist, Puerto Rican police detective Jimmy Vega, who returns in a sixth installment, is on the hunt for a predator stalking the unforgiving landscape of immigrant America. Before I go, I encourage you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, and thank you for following along wherever you get your podcast. Now, have a great week, and I'll talk to you next time on The Thriller Zone.